All right, I think everyone got a handout that I gave you today. It says number 37 on the bottom. That doesn't indicate where in the book you're to put it. You might just put it after the scene, scene three page, which is the sixth chapter. 37 is the slide number up on the board. It's how many slides that we've covered up to this point in our time in Revelation. But I feel like in our discussion last week, when we talked about the picture itself and the impressions that we might have of Revelation chapter 6, that I may not have been sufficiently clear in describing the parallel nature of the sevens that are mentioned from chapter 6 down through chapter 16, which forms a good portion of the book's material and essence that we're going to be discussing in the future. So I wanted to spend a few more minutes talking about that, the unsealing of the seven seals, the seventh seal bringing forth a series of seven trumpets that are sounded as warnings, and that, of course, leading to the seven bowls of wrath that would be poured out that are mentioned in chapter 16 of the text. This chart that is up on the overhead and you received a copy of in the class this morning appears on page 79 of Robert Harkrider's Revelation Commentary. So if you would like to see it there in that book, you can find it there on page 79. I put that note at the bottom of the page. And I think it helps to picture the position that Harkrider takes. It's one that is taken by Brother Homer Haley, as well as William Hendrickson. Those are the three commentaries that I am using as primary sources as I'm going through and studying this. One of the things that I mentioned at the beginning of our study is that depending upon the date that you ascribe to the book of Revelation, whether it was written in AD 69 or thereabouts, or whether it was written in AD 96, the reign of Emperor Nero in the early date, and in the late date, the reign of Emperor Domitian, that basically colors the way you interpret the book. This is another thing that would color the way you interpret the book as to whether you consider that these scenes are run in parallel. It seems to fit the structure of the book. It seems to fit properly. The context and the descriptions are good to follow and a good way of looking at it. I'm not, again, there's very little that I want to be dogmatic about other than the basic fundamental truths that are contained. With regard to the symbols and such, it's a little bit more difficult for us to be dogmatic about what we say and different views that are held. We're going to describe a little bit of that in our discussion today, or at least I think so, if we can get that far. But this chart, if you'll notice, I read a quote to you, and I'll read it again from Robert Harkrider in his book. It says, "The information that's revealed in the seven seals is more general in nature, as the first six seals give a panorama of God's dealings with mankind on earth, beginning with his coming and culminating in the scene of final judgment." So if you'll notice that when we say running simultaneously, I don't mean that the seven trumpets correspond with the seven seals, or that the seven bowls of wrath correspond with the seven trumpets. And I'm hopeful that I didn't leave that perception with you in our discussion last week. I really hadn't got into it yet sufficiently. And I thought that this chart would basically show this, that we have an overarching theme that is contained in the book of Revelation that begins with the coming of Christ, ends with the final judgment. And the materials that are contained in that are contained within these seven seals. Within that time frame, there is the seven warnings that are signaled with the seven trumpets, as well as the seven plagues of the seven bowls of wrath that shows the successful defeat of the wickedness or the wicked and the wickedness that was present, and the ultimate victory of God and of Christ. And so that's what I want you to kind of keep in mind as we look at that, that this is a structure that we're going to follow in the class as I teach it. And it may be something where you might, in your own personal studies, differ from a little bit. But this particular construct that we're following, again, men that I trust with regard to their scholarship of the book. And as I've read other commentaries on Revelation and other views that are held, this seems to be the most cohesive and does a good job of describing these things. This is kind of what we're going to follow in construct, at least, in looking at the next 10 chapters or so of the book. So you'll have there the first section that is discussed with regard to the book of Revelation is the coming of Christ. Secondly, a description of the persecution. We're going to see that especially with regard to the first two seals that are opened. And then as time goes on, there is that expression that is contained within the book of God's avenging of the blood of the saints. We're talking about a time of persecution in the church. We're talking about a time of martyrdom in the church. And there is the cry, when will we be avenged on the part of the martyrs? And the expression that is given by God, wait a little while till that time is complete. And he gave them the robes of white. And this is that period of time where the conflict exists. This is what the book of Revelation is about. That there is conflict between God and Satan. It's seen in the background, but it's also seen in the foreground with regard to the conflict that the agents of Satan visit upon men in the physical world. Now, that's something that is true with us today as well. We don't want to diminish the fact that the primary audience for the book of Revelation would, of course, be those to whom it was written there in the first century. These are things that must shortly come to pass. And the trials and tribulations were certainly visited upon the Christians in the first century. And some of the things that we're going to be talking about, we're talking about persecution, we're talking about economic deprivation and other things, as well as the conflict that exists because we are God's children and how we will suffer as a result of it, but the vindication that comes ultimately in the end as the battle is going on in the background between God and Satan, between the Christ child and the serpent. And as we look at those things, we find that ultimate spiritual battle of Armageddon, the victory of God's kingdom as it stands, and then the final judgment that brings an end to all things. So these are the things that we're going to kind of look at as we go through the narrative of Revelation chapter 6. And so the seventh seal would open the second series, which is the seven trumpets. Those are warnings that God issues to the wicked before the judgment. And then from the seventh trumpet or warning comes the seven bowls of wrath or plagues visited upon men, showing the defeat of the wicked. We'll get into a discussion of those kinds of things as we get through these 10 chapters that we're going to be discussing. All right, so I just wanted to make note of that before we go on into more material. Anyone have any question about the basic narrative that this chart is establishing? Any questions about the chart itself before we go on? I hope that that's a supplement that will help you, and I would encourage you to put it with your other notes. All right, so then let us, I'm going to put that chart up just for a moment for the people at home so that they can see it. I neglect sometimes to put it up there. It's always on me for some reason in that regard. But I do want you to notice in that third scene, in those 17 verses in chapter 6, that we talk first of all about the overall picture, the impressions that you get. That's what we covered in the previous slide before the one that we have up on the board at this time. And now what I would like to do is to discuss the purpose of the scene. In other words, in principle, what does God intend for us to learn from chapter 3 or chapter 6, verses 1 through 17 in this third scene? So I've got my thoughts, but again, I'd like again to hear what you have put down, if you have anything in that material, anything that you would seek to posit for our consideration. Anybody want to try? With regard to the purpose of the scene. Yes, Josh. Okay.
And prepared to, you know, be on that good side of
the life of Okay. That's a good point. Preparation is a key thing. I'll just give you an example, just a very different one. But of course, as part of the chronic leukemia that I have blood tests, and I have infusions that I've had, needles stuck in my arm more in the last year and a half than I had in my entire life previous, put it that way. And I don't have a needle phobia, but it's still, it's an invasive thing that comes in your arm, and I have to kind of steel myself for it. I have to prepare myself for it. So I get set down, and if I were to look at them taking blood, I would pass out. That's just a physiological reaction that I have. And so I get ready. I say, okay, it's coming, and I look away, and I stay looking away, focused on something else till she's finished, and I'm fine. It's not a problem. I just can't watch it. So I prepare myself for the prick. Never bad. It never hurts particularly. It's a mild thing. It's not anything big or difficult. But I still have to prepare myself. And in the preparation of it, it's something that is helpful to me. Now, that's just a small thing, but it serves to illustrate that point. If you, as a Christian, are hit with persecution and you're not expecting it, I think a good description of that is found in the seed for the sower, of the ground that is rocky, where the plant springs up quickly, but it has no root, no foundation, and as such, whenever trial or tribulation hits, it wilts because there is not that root. But an individual who is aware of what is coming and has that ability to steel himself and to prepare himself in that regard is one who is going to, as a result of that, better be able to handle those things. So preparation is certainly something that is accomplished by God saying, this is what's coming. And for them understanding what they can expect as a result of the devil and his work. So that's a good point. Anybody else want to add anything to that? All right, well, I would like to just show you what I've got. And if there's anything else you want to add to it at the end, feel free to do so. But we note again that these events that are covered by Revelation begin with the coming of the Messiah. And so now, as we have described that in chapters 4 and 5, that lamb that has been, as though it had been slain, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, and the victory that is there. Now that we are prepared in understanding that we have that victory, now he begins to note that the battle is joined. In other words, again, chapters 4 and 5, when we discussed that in our previous studies, also serve to buoy us up and to give us encouragement and to prepare us, because indeed, this was going to be a difficult time for Christians. In that first century, it certainly was. Many suffered martyrdom or economic deprivation and other kinds of problems as a result of their service to the Master. And we will certainly do so as well. That's what the events are in Revelation. It's what it's talking about in these visions. So this is the beginning of the joining of that battle, if you will, against Satan and against his minions. And though the end is certain, Satan's going to impact the lives of the faithful. The descriptions that are given here with regard to the opening of the seals and the conversations that are held with regard to the cry of the martyrs in chapter 5, these are arresting. They are something that indicates a really difficult time. I don't know that we as Christians living in America, and all of us have been raised with religious liberty, that we can quite understand the experiences of the people in the first century. We can talk about those who live godly in Christ will suffer persecution, and it may be that we have suffered to one extent or another, but what they are going through is something that could truly cause individuals to falter, to lose their faith, to become despairing. And this is the way it's going to be for this period of time. And so Satan is allowed to impact the lives of the faithful while they're here on the earth. You'll notice again in verse 11 of the text, when they cried out in verse 10, the martyrs, "How long until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell in the earth?" And his answer was, it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed as they were was complete. In other words, how long before we're avenged? The avenging is going to come. God will avenge the blood of the martyrs, but the slaughter of the martyrs, the the persecution of the faithful, the martyrdom that was ongoing had not yet finished. There was time. They had to be patient. There was time to come when these things would suffer. So that's a part of it, is letting us know, and letting the disciples in the first century especially know that it was going to be hard. But ultimately, in the end, the wrath of the Lamb could not be withstood. And that's a picture that we get in the sixth chapter as well. So those are the things that I wanted to note about the kind of principle or the reason why this scene is present in this. And of course, we could also say, if you were going a different direction in what was intended by the principle, the significance of the uncovering of the seven seals, the execution of God's will for man and for Satan and his minions and their ultimate end and all those kinds of things. This is an important arc that we are familiar with if we read the prose of the other books of the Bible. But in this apocalyptic language, in such symbolic terms and vivid terms, we see the battle joined, that God and the devil are fighting together. And the devil is given some abilities that will impact us while we're on the earth, but ultimately we will be avenged and God will be victorious. The end is settled from the beginning. And that's something that's seen with regard to the ark that is found in the opening of the seven seals of the book. All right. Questions, comments before we get into the next slide? Yes, Dick. Yeah, I think that when we look at that text in 2 Timothy chapter 3, all who live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution, that we need to understand the difference, the different types of persecution that we may suffer. I don't think that any individual who lives for Christ in this day and time will escape persecution from either the religious errorists or more importantly, those who are secularists, those who do not believe in God or do not accept Christ as Messiah. It's going to happen. It just doesn't happen necessarily to the extent today, or at least to us in our nation today, as it does to those in the first century. To say that we don't suffer persecution would be wrong, and that's not what Dick said, but we don't suffer it to the extent. We don't have as much of it as they did in the first century. You talk to let's say a young person who is active in sharing their faith while they're in school. You'll find individuals who are persecuted as a result of their stand for truth. You find individuals who have the audacity to speak up online with regard to their faith. They will suffer the scorn and insults of men as a result of that. Or if you go and talk to individuals who are unbelievers, who are not receptive to the truth, then you will be mistreated as a result of your faith. And then we find that there are even maybe non-violent, but nevertheless intrusive limitations that are beginning to be put upon us by the government as a result of the fact that being a Christian is no longer something that is acceptable by many. I think it's an interesting thing that there have been those who have been professed Christians who are what we might say conservative Christians that believe in the inerrancy of the Bible, who are said not to be qualified for public service precisely because they believe in the creation account. Because they believe in the role that a woman plays in the home, because they believe in the sanctity of life from the womb. Those kinds of things in the minds of some make you a fanatic, make you an extremist, and make you an idiot, make you superstitious, make you hateful, and make you unqualified to serve and hold any public office whatsoever. And that's the way that many feel about it. And unfortunately, it's becoming more systemic in our government. So just because we aren't suffering physical persecution doesn't mean that we don't suffer persecution in our day as well. But that's a part of being a child of God. We're going to talk a little bit about that when we get into the opening of the seals, that the sword follows the preaching of the gospel. It always has and it always will. And it's something we need to steel ourselves for and be aware of. All right. Appreciate that, Dick. Okay, let's go on then to the practice. And what we talk about when we're talking about practice is applications that can be drawn from the text, both to those who were living in the first century as well as to us. Those things were pretty much identical in our first scene that we discussed in chapters, or the second scene, chapters 4 and 5. Maybe some differences here, though. So as the disciples in the first century read chapter 6 and read this particular scene of the opening of the six seals, what do you think they would and should get out of it? How should it impact them in their lives? And what principles should they put into play with regard to their faith as a result of it? Anybody want to? I know this is hard. I do want you to try whenever you do this. Because again, understand this, that there's not necessarily, there are wrong answers. Don't misconstrue. I mean, don't misunderstand me. If you get it completely wrong, you need to scratch it out and replace it with what we do talk about. But there are things that I might have as an application or see as an application that you might not. And so I want you to try to fill it out as best you can on your own. Listen to what I have to say. If you want to share one of those things with us, then please feel free to do so. Yes, Josh?
There's one specific, it's for them and us, but in a way it's easier to understand and applied. Mm-hmm. So it's looked at differently to them. But anyway, Christ left and he said, "I will return." And a lot of them were thinking, well, it's going to be pretty quick, my lifetime. You see other areas where they wanted to share out a way, just didn't know who had. And so this is
good point. Yeah. So think about that. I mean, his first letter that Paul wrote to the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians, he indicated to them that, or indicated that there were individuals who were expecting it to happen at any time for Christ to come again. And he basically said, no, it's not time yet. There are some things that have to happen first before he comes. When he comes, he's going to come as a thief in the night. We won't know why, when it will be. But don't stop working and don't stop, he told the Macedonians this again and again. Don't be busybodies. Don't divorce yourself from society. You've got to get to work because your responsibility and the way we prepare is to live for Christ, and then everything else will take care of itself when Christ comes again. But they did have that idea, and it surprised them. Paul, they asked Paul, what about those who are dead in Christ? And he said, don't worry about them. They will rise first. And they were concerned about that because they were expecting it to happen immediately. And it certainly didn't happen. And I think here there's some understanding of that. So the idea of preparation that you'd mentioned in the previous slide is one that I wanted to make note of, especially here, is that they needed to recognize that this affliction was going to continue. When they looked at the opening of those seals and they saw the red horse and they saw the black horse and they looked at these kinds of things. What they were becoming aware of is that they would be persecuted, that there would be deprivation, that there would be plagues, that there would be famines, and that there would be wars, and there would be a conflict, and God's judgment would come upon men. And they needed to be aware of that in order to prepare. And of course, the lesson of Revelation, the message, the overriding theme is God wins. And because God conquers, then we as his will conquer as well. but it's going to be a bloody battle. And boy, when you talk about blood and gore and the symbology of slaughter and on those things, we've got plenty of it to read about and to look at when we get into this discussion from chapter 6 all the way through chapter 16 especially. So keeping that in mind, as we make that application, it's that same basic thing. We're no different than they are. And as we've already talked about with Dick's comment and my explanation, that our persecution might be somewhat different, but it's not guaranteed to be so. Until all things are completed, these kinds of things will continue. And I make note again in verse 11 with regard to the martyrs. And the idea is to wait a little while longer until all of the fellow servants and brethren who would be killed are killed. I don't think that's finished in the first century as something that continues on. And again, the primary application was that there was a big thing that was happening at that time. But this work of God avenging the blood of the saints is something that is ongoing and will continue until that final battle is won, the last victor, or the last enemy that is defeated, over which Christ is victorious, is death. And then comes the end. And so that's something to keep in mind as well. And then finally, the second final point in that regard is that though the persecution was dire then, we can expect that same measure. So we've discussed that already. Now, we mentioned actually last week the question that was found. Who can, questions asked in verse 17 at the end of the chapter. For the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? Now this is an indication again of the avenging of God and the judgment of God upon mankind. And the great and powerful men that are mentioned in that verse, those individuals are quaking and they're melting under the power and the wrath and the majesty of Christ. Who is able to stand? That is the question that we want to answer in our study of Revelation. And the answer is something that is very clear. Those who are able to stand are the faithful. They will be the ones to be resurrected, to rise and to meet the Lord in the air when this destruction is visited upon the great and the mighty. We win, in other words. And there's a text in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 that I think does a very good job of expressing this. 2 Thessalonians 1 and verse 6. It's a righteous thing with God to repay with tribulation those who trouble you, and to give you who are troubled rest with us when the Lord Jesus is revealed from heaven with his mighty angels, in flaming fire taking vengeance on those who do not know God and those who do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. And by the way, in this context, it's not only those who are disobedient to the gospel, but those who are visiting oppression upon the Christians for their faith. These shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power when he comes in that day, to be glorified in his saints, to be admired among all those who believe, because our testimony among you was believed. Okay? So keep that in mind. Who's able to stand against the wrath of God? And the answer, again, who is able to stand against God's wrath? No one. But in the end, when God's wrath is visited upon mankind, who will be able to stand? Only those who are faithful. That's something for us to keep in mind. All right. Questions, comments about the practice before we get into the characters and symbols of the chapter? All right, this is the one that, you know, generally takes a little bit longer for us to get through all these symbols. And in the discussion of the symbols, we get most of the teaching in the book. There will be a few notes we'll want to share with you when we finish these. But this is probably going to take a couple of weeks to get into it. So let's go as quickly as we can on some, because some I want to spend a little bit more time on. When we talk about the characters and symbols of the vision found in chapter 6, then first of all, we want to identify and define the Lamb that is mentioned in chapter 6 and verse 1. Now, this is one that we've already visited, so we'll ask that question. When he said, I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, who is the Lamb that's under consideration here? Christ. Okay, so we already identified the references to the Lord. He is described in chapters 4 and 5 as the Lamb as though it had been slain, who was worthy to open the seals of the book. Also referred to as the Lion of the tribe of Judah, in that context, also referred to as the root of David in the context of chapters 4 and 5. That goes over into this particular discussion. So he said he's able to open the seals. There's reason for rejoicing. There's no reason for us to be concerned. And now that this has segued into the next vision, he's actually opening the seals. Okay? So then, the second one in chapter 6 and verse 1, there was I heard like the noise of thunder, one of the four living creatures saying, come and see. And by the way, just so that you'll note this, the textual criticism indicates that the "and see" that is found both in the King James Version and the New King James Version most probably was added by a scribe. It's not in the original text. It's not particularly significant at all because we're talking about the vision and there are references in other places. Similarly, there is the call for John to either come see or I said, I looked and saw, those kinds of things. So it's not surprising that maybe a scribe, and this is what happens typically with mistakes that are made in the context of any particular passage, is that a scribe sees it and he thinks, well, this must have been left off, and he adds it. And as a result of that, there is an error that creeps in, but it's such an obvious one because even though it's in one particular manuscript, there are so many other manuscripts that don't have it, that it's obvious that that particular manuscript was corrupted in that one place. Textual criticism is a wonderful thing. And it helps us to understand that we've got an accurate Bible. But I do want to remind you that the King James Version, New King James Version, were translated in the 17th century. And it was in the 19th century that there were several manuscripts that were uncovered, much more ancient in time, that differed with some things and small things. So when you'll see in the King James Version, New King James Version, something like come and see, and you look at a New American Standard or an English Standard or an NIV, and it just says come. That's the reason why there may be a difference. It's just a different group of manuscripts that are given the greater weight to make a decision as to what should be included and what does not or should not be. So he either says, come and see, or he says, come. It was one of the four living creatures. So the symbol, who are the four living creatures? Again, just give me a quick and concise answer because it's something we've already identified. Would it be right to call them angels? Rephrase that. Is there any place in any other part of God's Word, Old Testament or New Testament, to which these four living creatures are noted and where are they described as being angels? Cherubim and seraphim. Those are words that are used, and they are used in other places having reference to angels. You'll remember in our discussion a couple of weeks ago with regard to the four living creatures, they seem to be created by God, just as other angels are, for the purpose of worshiping God. We are told a cherubim was placed at the Garden of Eden, at the entrance to the Garden of Eden, with the sword to guard the way to the Tree of Life. And there is reference in Ezekiel, in a vision that Ezekiel had, to the four living creatures in which they are referred to as cherubim. And the phrase seraphim is used for that high order as well. So we're talking about creatures. Now the description that is given, again, is indicative of wisdom. It's indicative of vision and speed. It's indicative of service and strength. It's indicative of power and authority. And these descriptions, again, are metaphors of the type of beings that these individuals are. But they are very high beings at the throne of God, and who are given directions on this occasion to John to come and to see this particular vision. All right, so those are the easy ones. Those are the ones we've discussed already. So now let's talk about what might be the most difficult discussion or the difficult understanding as to who's under consideration or what's under consideration in the opening of the seal. So he noticed in verse 2, he said, I look and behold a white horse. He who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. There are basically two different views that are held as to who's under consideration in this. I want you to understand that these seals indicate, again, the avenging of God against the battle against Satan. Whenever you hear the idea of conquering, if we're talking about some kind of a physical manifestation of the conquering that's being done, which we'll see certainly in later seals that are opened, then you would have to consider as a part of that that there is a conquering that is being done in a physical sense. And that's a position that many hold in this regard. However, there is another, what I think to be a right view of this, that we'll talk about in a few moments. Now, we're going to talk more about that when we get to the one who sits on top of the horse. But the word, or the horse, when you look at all of the horses, the four horses of the apocalypse that are found in Revelation chapter 6, they are conveyors of the harbingers. In other words, they are the steeds upon which the ones who set upon them set upon them. Okay, so what's significant about the horses? The description, there's no description given concerning the nature of the horses other than the color. So what I would like to do is just kind of talk about the color a little bit and then get into the one who sat on it, where I think the greatest symbolism in the language is used. I do want to note concerning the horses that there is a similar vision that was given to Zechariah. You might want to write this down. Zechariah chapter 6 and verses 1 through 3. Zechariah 6, 1 through 3. Notice this. I turned and raised my eyes and looked, and behold, four chariots were coming from between two mountains, and the mountains were mountains of bronze. With the first chariot were red horses, the second chariot black horses, the third chariot white horses, and the fourth chariot dappled horses, strong steeds. And I answered and said to the angel who talked to me, "What are these, my Lord?" And it goes in and describes it. This vision is a different vision. You'll notice that the order of the horses that are mentioned in that, they're listed, the colors of the horses are listed in a different order. The only thing that I would like to add with regard to this, or note with regard to Zechariah chapter 6, is that this imagery concerning horses coming and the horses bringing in the chariots or the one who sat upon them, these judgments of God or these messages from God, that these things are images that would be familiar to the Jewish Christians of the first century. When we talk about these kinds of things, the thing to keep in mind is that the language of the apocalyptic book of the New Testament and the apocalyptic language, the symbols and the visions that are found in this book, they were familiar to them in the first century. Sometimes can be less familiar to us because 2,000 years have passed. We're trying to look back and we're trying to understand these things. But it's something that when the Jews, especially in the first century, and the Jewish Christians became Christians, this language of Zechariah, the language of Ezekiel, the language of Daniel, these are things that would be familiar to them, not so familiar to the uninitiated, especially the secular government and such. The message of the book of Revelation is a message of insurrection. It is a subversive message. If you think about the fact that there is a book that was going around telling these Christians that God was going to come and destroy the Roman government, and the Roman government was going to fall, and it was set in prosaic language, and this is how it's going to happen, it would read almost like a playbook. In other words, this is the plan. These are the blueprints as to how we're going to evolve ourselves in an insurrection against the Romans. And that would have been something that would have been dealt with by the Roman government. This language is, that's that symbolic language of the Jews. But the Jews would be familiar with these kinds of things. The Christians would be familiar with these kinds of imagery. In our text, if there is any significance to the horse, it's going to be in the color. So in this horse, in chapter 6 and verse 2, it is a white horse. When we talk about the color white, we've already discussed that. Already, what is significant about the color white as we have used it previously?
Purity.
I'm sorry?
Purity.
Purity and righteousness. Purity and righteousness. We talked about the white robes. We talked about Christ as the Passover lamb in the white robe. Those kinds of things. Purity and righteousness. Okay, so keep that in mind. I think it is a significant point to be made as we seek to establish the proper view of he who sat here in chapter 6 and verse 2. So these are the two major views. If you read all the books or commentaries on the book of Revelation, the scholars who are trying to make heads or tails of these things, the first is that this is a militaristic occurrence that would have a parallel in secular circumstances, that there was a general or a conquering individual. He who sat had a bow, a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. And if you look at that and you take the position that this has reference to insurgents and defeats of various aspects of the Roman Empire, there's really only one possibility in that regard, and that is that it is a picture of a Parthian general. And if you want to take the time to do it, feel free to do so. You can go into Wikipedia or some other Google search and you can read about Parthia. Parthia at the time of the end of the first century and going into the second century was actually nearing an end to its reign, but it was the preeminent opposition to Rome. In other words, the Roman Empire was broad, and it was the Parthians in the first century, the end of the first century, that were making incursions and battles, and as a result of that, conquering certain parts of the empire, the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, of course, was already decadent. It was already beginning to falter a bit, but the far reaches of that empire, this Parthian Empire, which was much smaller, much less strong, and in fact faltered itself, basically coming from the area of Iraq and the regions and environs there, was in a battle with Rome. And, or with the outer reaches of the Roman Empire. And incursions were being made. And so there is the position that is taken that that the Parthian general who is coming in, who is conquering the lands and a thorn in the side of the Romans would be what's under consideration here. Okay? It's very difficult for me to speak to that specifically, but again, because I don't hold to that position, but that's one possibility. And there, you know, again, we can give... Every individual may have different view. Let me rephrase that. It's not just two views. I'm just saying that there are two major views that are held of this. I want to very quickly just today, just in the last 2 minutes we have, indicate my position. We'll talk about it next week. We can have comments concerning others who may feel differently. I mentioned last week my view that the he who sat on and had a bow had a reference to the Christ. This is an indication of Christ coming to conquer and the conquering. In other words, he starts off with regard to the opening of these seals to indicate, again, that through this battle and through all of these things are going to be happening and the evil that's going to be happening to Christians, that Christ ultimately is going to be victorious. Again, I wanted you to note that the studies that I'm doing, there are men that I trust that I'm studying with regard to commentaries to help understand the context and such. And the three primary sources that I'm utilizing in my studies, in addition to, of course, God's Word, which is the primary thing, but that I think have a good grasp on what Revelation teaches, are Robert Harkrider and Homer Haley, and then William Hendrickson. I believe his first name is William Hendrickson. And so we're going to talk about that. I'm going to give you some of the arguments that William Hendrickson makes as to why this has reference to the victorious Christ going forth as the conqueror of evil in the world. But I want you to note that there is unanimity among those men with regard to this. Now, we don't have time to go through the arguments entirely. I do want to note one passage that we'll come back to later, just so that you'll have an understanding why it may be that this has reference to the Christ. Go to Revelation chapter 19 and read with me verse 11. Then we'll draw it to a close and we'll pick up next week with a study of this. And I'll give everyone an opportunity to discuss it as long as we need to before we go on to the other seals. In chapter 19 and verse 11, here we have a white horse and one who sat upon it. And the one sitting upon the white horse in chapter 19 and verse 11, I saw heaven open, behold a white horse, and he who sat on him was called faithful and true, and with righteousness he judges and makes war. That time, in chapter 19 and verse 11, on that occasion, it is obviously that the one who's sitting on the white horse in chapter 19 and verse 11 is the Christ. And what we have to determine or to establish or what we posit is that the one who is sitting on the white horse in Revelation chapter 6 and verse 2 is the same one in Revelation chapter 19 and verse 11. We'll explain why we think that's the case next week. We'll give others an opportunity to differ or to give their explanations of these things as well. All right. Appreciate very much everyone's kind consideration today. And we'll pick up there with the opening of the first seal and who sat upon the white horse in our discussion next week. All right. Thank you.